It's 10 o'clock. It's Tuesday morning, and that means it's time for Tom and Shane, Business and Politics. Tommy Gilhuff in Bozeman, Montana. Shane Montalban, half man, half amazing, is in Kamloops, Canada, making this a totally international show. And if you're just joining us, take a moment to hit the subscribe button. You'll find that in the lower right-hand corner or under the video itself if you're watching on YouTube. And I'll wait while you hit the button. So, you know, we'll just... Did you hit it? Did you subscribe? Did you hit it? Well, okay. Hey, if you want to support us monetarily, why wouldn't you? I mean, there is some cost involved with putting these things on, so I know you want to support us. So there's a link in the description below on how to do that. And if you want to make videos like this yourself, well, we use StreamYard, and we love it, and it's easy to use. And there's a link to a free version of it in the description below, so you will want to do that. Also, I need to remind you that Tom and Shane... We write on medium.com, and links to our articles are in the description below. So you will certainly want to read our pearls of wisdom over at medium.com. And today we've got to talk about mining. Will mining kill the planet? What's going to happen when we take every resource in the planet out of the ground, Shade? What are we going to do?
I don't know. It's one of these things that you look at and it sort of boggles yours and my mind, if not those that pay attention, that this whole green planet and the, you know, Green New Deal and we got to save it. It's going to be destroyed in 12 years. When you look at the value of mining and what it does, it's 10% of the global economy. I mean, that's how big it is, number one. Second of all, the cash flow generated from it is like third only to sovereign debt in the airline industry, and then there, of course, just the size. I mean, the world consumes 100 billion tons of materials annually, otherwise mined materials. And over 3.2 billion tons of metals are in that number. So this is not a small game. It's big time.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's 10% of the gross domestic product and making it pretty good size. Also, if you want to start a mine, it's $500 million to $1 billion, depending on the location and what you're going after and climate and how to get there and transportation and all kinds of other things. Workforce, and the top 40 companies made $656 billion in 2020, but the industry, the profit margins decreased, Shane, 14% over the last 10 years or so. So mining isn't quite as lucrative as it once was.
Well, and that's given to one of the three bigs. You know, the three bigs basically are gold, silver and copper, copper being the largest, mm-hmm. That's a mine. I mean, right. as amount, and the price of it's dropped. So that has a lot to do with it. One of the fascinating things when you read about mining and come to understand its importance and what's involved in it is learning how deep mines are. Mm-hmm. There's basically four ways to mine. You can hard rock, that's where you dig a hole in the ground. You can heap leach, which we all know about panning or out of rivers. Then there's cyanide heap leaching. That's where you use cyanide over a man-made pond with a liner with water and cyanide that is sprayed on the material laid out. Dissolves principally the gold in it, and then it's built on an angle so it flows down. Has to be recovered, and then it's that liquid is run through coal filters to recover the gold, and then they recycle it. But it's horrific. And then there's open pit mining. So my fascination always was the hard rock, the deep mining, because how deep. When you go to South Africa, you know, It's great to visit all the great spots, natural spots. But boy, you, two things you learn when you go and see these mines in South Africa that are like 200 years old is, you know, that 12,000 to 13,000 feet deep. I mean, they have to have huge surface refrigeration, you know, plants, you know, to circulate the air down below, because, you know, that's to get it down to 82 degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, it's at that depth, it's usually around 124. So that's a pretty significant amount. The other fascinating thing is that, you know, the deepest borehole ever made will be fascinating for, you know, is in Murmansk, Russia. It was 40,230 feet. But that's just a borehole. They wanted to outdo the U.S., who had gone down 20,000 feet in the Pacific. But anyway, however, I just wanted to make that comment. The other observation I wanted to make is that talk briefly about open pit mining, because that's surface mining, and it results in either hard rock processing, smelting, or even heap leaching. But it's a dirty business, because it's at the surface and it's open. You know, the largest.
There's our picture of an open pit mine.
You can see the damage that does. You can see, this is where the gigantic equipment is used. And I mean, the trucks have, you know, 40-foot high wheels, and, you know, they've got these super scoops that, like, will dump, you know, 5 tons of ore into the back of one of those trucks. And they take 3 or 4 dumps, and then they have to climb all the way out of that hole to take it to the smelter, or, you know, the recovery area, and then drive back down. And it's a remarkable place. Largest open pit mine in the United States is, of course, Fort Knox in Alaska, and they produce about 200,000 ounces of gold a year. But when you look at the list of the largest mining companies in the world, you're amazed, because, you know, four of them are Swiss and British, or Australian British, and you know, the top three, that's Glencore, BHP, and Rio Tinto. BHP, of course, is in Australia, owned by a woman, by the way, quite fascinating. Brazil has a very large mining company, but China has four. And of course, India has a very large coal mine that nobody wants to talk about mining at all. And that's why we're talking about it today, because all these things were the numbers, the size. This would not be a popular thing for global warming enthusiasts to talk about, because without this, there's no windmills, there's no solar panels,
there's no battery,
there's nothing. But boy, we can't talk about that. Look, real quick. When you visit South Africa, and they've been mining down there for 300 or 400 years, so we all been to rivers with dikes. Well, the earth they've hauled out of the ground have created mounds that they've, you know, stacked that waste on, that are anywhere from 700 to 800 feet high, and anywhere from 200 to 300 yards wide. You know, the Australians brag that if they started to crush and heap leach all the waste material that they've taken out of the ground, they could produce as much as, you know, gold as they found in the ground. So these numbers are staggering, folks. They really are.
Yeah. Well, the hard rock mining, the things that I'm doing this for the benefit of the people who are listening to us but not watching YouTube. Well, come on, you know,
true. I gotta
read this stuff, all right?
Yeah,
for the benefit of the people who are listening to us and not watching us, all right? The underground hard rock mining, that's where we go after the normal stuff: gold, silver, iron, copper, zinc, nickel, tin, and lead. And, you know, those are the most common things, I guess, from the hard rock mining that Shane's talking about. You dig a hole, you go down there, and you find whatever is down there.
Yeah, they're found in what's called seams.
Yeah.
And so when you build the main shaft, off that shaft, you build adits, they're called, which are basically caves. And you're going through hard rock, because most of these are found in hard rock formations, you know, marble, granite, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And they fall literally are the result of igneous or volcanic activity, where the minerals have separated from the rock itself and then created a seam like a stream through rock. And, you know, it can be a quarter of an inch to an inch to a 5 feet deep, you know, like coal, or, you know, 100 feet deep, like coal or salt. But the remarkable thing is how extensive it is. The open pit mine in Montana, which you're familiar with, one of the biggest in the world for copper, Butte, Montana. The adits off the open pit itself, you know, they went actually dug adits right under the city of Butte in you know, back in the 19th and 20th century, you know, they'd cave in and you know, buildings from Butte would fall through the ground. So there's some great stories in mining to talk about it. Like.
Yeah. Well, we talked a little bit about heap leaching, extracts precious metals, coppers and uranium from ore using chemical reactions that Shane talked about earlier. And we re-separate them later. It's I guess it's sort of like if you dig a shovel full of earth, there's rocks and there's dirt. And if you want the rocks, you use water to get rid of the dirt and you got the rocks. So sort of like that.
So heap leaching is great. I got to tell you two stories because they're important to everyone that is an environmentalist. Two of the most famous 20th century miners were Robert Friedland and of course, Mr. Monk from Barrick. But I'll tell you about Robert Friedland first, real quick. So Robert Friedland lived in Washington State. He was a Christmas tree grower, so he could grow his pot in, you know, amongst the trees. And some guys from Vancouver came down and offered him some stock, 50,000 shares, you know, to get the mining rights on his property. He said, okay, sure, that's great. What do I care? And, you know, so they go back to Vancouver and, you know, 6 months later, he's looking, you know, at his stock. It was, you know, started out at a nickel and all of a sudden it went to $5 and whoa, he sold it. Went, this is interesting. So he got to understand how to fund and raise money through Vancouver. Went to Colorado, bought up a old mining mine, the Summitville mine. And lo and behold, he discovered because of heap leaching, which was being considered then, that he could use it. So here he is on top of a mountain, you know, up to 3,500 feet. And he starts, you know, taking this ore out, crushing it, building these ponds. He didn't line them back then. But he did, you know, he poured the cyanide in and then dumped the material in and, as I said, filtered it out, you know. And long story short, the recovery wasn't great because what he found is he could only produce or work the heap leaching like 4 months of the year because the temperature is too high. It was too hot. The elevation was too high. So at first, the Galactic started out great. And did really well, could double digit stock, and they had some pretty good production. But then they ran into this problem with the heap leaching, literally leaching through the ground. And then in 1992, Galactic filed for bankruptcy because they couldn't, you know, they couldn't produce enough gold to cover the cost. The result of that, however, was that because of his failure to and no guidance, there was no regulation for heap leaching back then. 1991, there was a cease and desist order by the state of Colorado, and 85,000 gallons of cyanide water leaked into nearby creeks all the way down into the Colorado River. In the United States Environmental Protection Agency in 94, under the Superfund Emergency Response, had to clean it up, cost them about $155 million, and most that cyanide still in parts of the creeks of Colorado and the Colorado River. They chased after Friedland. They did finally settle with him for $30 million, but it was great because they chased him into Canada, and then he left and went to Singapore, and the U.S. government tried to, you know, grab all the stocks he had in a couple other mines he successfully developed, one at for nickel and so forth. But the amazing thing is he got away with it and settled for $30 million. Now, the other one that's really important is Barrick, because Barrick was created by a Canadian also named Peter Munk. Peter Munk was famous back in the 70s in Toronto as a promoter. In 1983, he started Barrick with the idea of going to Nevada, and he bought up all kinds of property in Nevada. He started heat bleaching down there, and he found the cost. He could produce it because it was hot, you know, solved that problem Friedland had. But the thing was, is he couldn't get the backing. Now, give you an idea how horrific heat bleaching is. If they can produce 0.6 ounce, like half an ounce of gold per ton, it becomes a profitable endeavor. Yeah. But he just couldn't get the funding to prove that. So he went to the Canadian government. He knew the prime minister at the time. And he said to them, lend me the gold from, the Bank of Canada, and I'll sell it on the market to fund my mine. And then when I produce the gold, I'll replace it. And he convinced the prime minister of Canada to do this. I mean, this guy was, he was a real promoter. That's what he did. So he ended up borrowing over 10 tons of gold from the Bank of Canada, sold it on the open market, raised the money, and bam, Barrick was born. And now to this day, it generates over $11 billion in operating revenue. And it was taken over, of course, by a Newmont Corporation in 2019, but it still trades on its own in Toronto. And there you go. What a legacy Mr. Munk had left for himself. He failed as a promoter, but as a miner, boy, he hit it big time. Two favorite stories about mining wanted to share with everyone.
All right. Bruce says talc, magnesium, lead, coal are all open pit mines over the country. We got that going for us. So there's a lot of this going on. And you're right, Shane, that a lot of people don't realize this. And some other things we want to get into, of course, is the electric car batteries. Lithium is the stuff that a lot of batteries have. But I want to talk about batteries for just a second, and then we'll go into the mining part of it. Mm-hmm. But one of the thing about batteries is that the ingredients in batteries are trade secrets of the battery manufacturer. So if they've got nickel in them or magnesium or cobalt or whatever is in this battery, if they can make a smaller, more powerful, stronger battery, longer lasting, holds the charge longer, whatever, they're going to patent that. And what problem this causes is with recycling. Because they don't want to tell a recycler what they've got in their batteries, because it's a trade secret of the company. So that's why we don't have any recycling yet of automobile batteries. Plus, there's not enough of them because the technology is so new. The batteries haven't worn out in a significant number to make it worthwhile to go, recycle these things. And they grind them down to powder, and then they separate out the minerals, but there has to be enough in there for the recycler to make a profit.
That's right.
And cobalt's the most valuable one. I don't know that the manufacturer is going to give up the percentage of cobalt in their battery, because that is a trade secret. Somebody else says, oh, that's the secret to the battery. You got X pounds of cobalt in it, or X ounces, or whatever. And you mix it with this and that, and now we can make the same battery they do. I'll just reverse engineer it. So lithium mining, obviously, is going to be a big deal as these car batteries start coming. So you can take it away on lithium.
Well, it didn't become important until the late 20th century. And lithium has a component, an electrolyte, and electrodes that have high electrode potential. It's a low atomic mass, allows it to have a high charge and power to weight ratio. Now, why is this important? Well, there's three types of batteries. There's a lead acid battery, which we all know, you use it in your car. It's 2.1 volts. And then you have the zinc carbon battery, which is 1.5 volts in similar size. Mm-hmm. And then along comes lithium, and wow, gee, this is like 3 volts. So because of the ability to generate voltage is higher, which isn't that much. It's like talking about the solar cell and how, you know, the cell is scalable, and batteries are to some degree, but as you say, the larger they become, the more expensive, number one. And then number two, they don't really hold the charge. You know, as you make it bigger, the charge doesn't last as long. And mm-hmm. that's why you're constantly having to recharge your lithium battery in your car, because yes, you use it up. But if it sat in your garage, it would not hold that charge for very long. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the other side of this methodology that we're always talking about with the global warming aspect. You know, it's not efficient. They tell you it is, but it's not. And it's expensive. You know, it's damned expensive to yeah. mine, to process, to smelt, and to create, you know, get the raw lithium to create the battery. It's very expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it is. I think you got to move something like 250 tons of earth to get enough lithium for a battery.
That's right.
So, you're very right. You know, it's a major destruction to the planet to move all this earth. And the other thing about these batteries is that a lot of things in the battery, Shane, you know, there are things that you can mine that are safe to mine, like coal and, you know, ore and stuff
gold.
Like that, gold. But there are also things that are dangerous to handle, when you mine these minerals. Some of them are dangerous to the body and the respiratory system, the dust and all that from this mining. And so many of these countries don't have the safeguards that are needed. And one of the things in the inflation package that was just passed is that over time they're going to force battery manufacturers to make everything in North America. So that's
that's right.
Now that's going to cost.
That's right. And one of the terrible things that they discovered with copper was when this was originally, because most of it was done with underground mining. Mm-hmm. One of the largest, in fact, the largest in the United Kingdom was in British Columbia, and it went under a mountain range from one side, Howe Sound, to the other sound on the other side, mm-hmm. where Indian River came into the fjord in Vancouver. But the importance of this was that as they dug through it, they came into the streams or seams of cyanide. The terrible reality they discovered was when that cyanide mixed with the copper, guess what it caused? It created acid, literally. Mm-hmm. So the acid water is what ended up closing down the mine, because there's just so much running water in British Columbia mines from the leaching of the water in down through hard rock. You couldn't fish in Howe Sound. I mean, it's one of the biggest sounds on the BC coast. For 100 years, because on this copper cyanide poison went into the bay, mm-hmm. and poisoned it. Poisoned all the fish. The stock of salmon, the stock of shrimp and crab. You know, you couldn't eat them even if they survived. So, yeah. The problem with copper, like I said, and cyanide is deadly. So this is another problem with mining. You come up with these, consequences that you didn't expect, and then it becomes compounded because it gets worse. It doesn't get better, mm-hmm. and sort of it has to drain itself out, so to speak.
Yeah, well, that's what we're talking about. That will this kill the planet? But are we going to have to? In order to build electric cars, is half of America going to be dug up looking for lithium, looking for nickel, looking for magnesium, looking for zinc, nickel, whatever, whatever goes into these batteries.
And, that's right. Well, the largest deposits of lithium found so far are South America in the landlocked plateaus of Uruguay and Paraguay, countries like that. But that's all now owned, you know, by the Chinese. They bought it all up. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they want to challenge Musk because, you know, he has two of the largest lithium battery production facilities in the world. Aside from free auto plants, mm-hmm. you know, he's got his own battery. He's vertically integrated, baby. He's got it all done. But, again, these are matters that we feel are important to talk about because everyone says, with regards to the global warming, we need to have a conversation about it. But no one wants to talk about mining. Like, no. You know, you bring up mining and it, well, good or bad, yeah. You know, you know, you bring up the bad, they go, see, we told you so. And then you go, yeah, but without it, we have nothing. Oh, no, that's not. No, we can find substitutes. No, you can't.
I guess there's not too many substitutes for gold and, you know, iron ore and all the other things we drag out of the ground. So, mining is one of those things that, it's one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of deals. You know, you gotta have it.
Well, yeah. And like here's another example. We'll take the top 16 companies producing steel. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 of 16 are Chinese.
Yeah.
You know, like, and in the top 10, you know, it's six, you know, like six of the top 10. The U.S. isn't even listed there. I mean, the U.S. Nucor is number 15 for steel production. And, you know, the Luxembourg is number 2 and Japan's number 4. South Korea's 5. Uh-huh. India's number 10. So, you know, you look at these facts and you realize it's the developing world that's doing a lot of the mining.
Yeah.
And they're not going to stop. They want to become first world countries. India and China want to become, and they're still not. I mean, they're growing leaps and bounds, but, you know, we always talk about the third world, the developing world, and the first world. You know, there's only a few of us that are, you know, the best country clubs to belong to. And China and India aren't two of them.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. Well, the other thing is you can't have steel and you can't have concrete without coal. Nothing else will get hot enough to produce, you know, the steel that we need or the coal or the, you know, the other that we need. So.
Well, and the Maastricht Treaty that was formulated for 100 years and signed in 1992, I believe it was, and then, you know, implemented to create the, you know, the EU mm-hmm. in 95, you know, in the treaty was a ban of steel production in Europe, which was major, particularly in Germany and England. You know, that's why Thatcher had such a problem. She said no to it, like she said about the currency. Mm-hmm. Luxembourg said no because, you know, they're a neutral country and they've never been involved in a war. But other European countries said, oh, okay. But this is why it's such a fascinating thing is that they gave that up to become what they are. And, mm-hmm. you know, and now they're having to depend on other countries for these economies they had. So, you know, when you look at certain problems the EU has had in its 20-year history, mm-hmm. you know, this has always been one of them. And, you know, now we just talk about, of course, gas from Russia.
Yeah. Well, another thing, Bruce brings up an excellent point. Still a million tons of copper in Butte, just don't have the technology to extract it yet. Smelting is frowned on and leaching's prohibited because of the, you know, the contamination they had over there now in the Berkeley pit in Butte, rather.
Yeah, it was a Canadian family, actually, that bought it. It was closed. And then when copper took off 10 years ago or 20 years ago, whatever it was, this family in Canada bought it and they opened it back up. And, you know, that gave them the cash flow to, you know, create a bigger company. Mm-hmm. It's mining is up and down. And here's an interesting fact I learned from being in Vancouver and in the penny market. In the history of a mining stock, the greatest percentage profit, most leverage, is at its beginning, when it's dirt cheap and it makes a discovery. So that, you know, I was involved in a countless number of 5, 10, 50 cent stocks that went to $5, double digits, you know, $10, $20, you know, literally overnight. And then, you know, they raised money to drill. How big's the deposit? Is it big enough to mine? And, you know, that took years, you know, 4 or 5 years of drilling. And then it takes, you know, you get to 7 years after 2 years of planning, if there was enough there to produce a mine, because like you pointed out at the beginning, it's like $700 million to get to that point. Then you need another $1 billion to build the infrastructure and the mine. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it can take a mine 10 years. And like you say, you know, $1 billion, $1.5 billion to go into production. Mm-hmm. So the stock, once it gets to the point where analysts realize how big the deposit is, they just run the numbers and they know exactly what the stock's going to be worth for 20 years. And that's what it trades at.
Yeah. Well, everybody seems to be worried that oil is a finite item, but we don't talk about mining of all the minerals being a finite item. Now, the earth is a pretty big place, Shane. I think you could mine a lot of it without you know, affecting the whole population of the planet, maybe. But there's going to reach a point, particularly as you know, as the electric vehicles and mm-hmm. other things happen, more mining is going to have to take place. It just will. So, you know.
Well, and in the 21st and the 22nd century, you know, in the next 200 years, given we survive, you know, it'll be recycling because, you know, when we discovered in our research and our talks, like 1 billion cars on the road today, so that's a lot of material to recycle and create another billion cars of some type, if you like.
Yeah.
But we'll see. As we have always said, you know, we have to get planes, trains, and automobiles off of oil because we need petrochemicals because everything is made of oil and we can't waste it.
Yeah.
You know, literally burn it off into the air. You know, it's like burning money, which, of course, we do that too.
Well, yeah. Just look at the inflation package. We just talk about burning money. Jeez.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, the joke about the inflation package was his comment last week that, you know, last month we had zero. Sir, the inflation rates, your government's saying 8.5%, but we had zero.
Yeah.
So there's zero inflation. And then
still 8.5.
Yeah. And then 4 days later, they pass this deflation package there's zero inflation.
The only good thing I can find in that package, Shane, is they're gonna plant about 1,000 trees somewhere.
That's right. And we know that doesn't work because, you know, 25 square feet of grass will produce more oxygen than 150 trees. So, it's a great idea. And that's why the planet is green. Yeah. You know, they keep saying there's this CO2 problem. Mm-hmm. And the UN in 2020, now we're 2 years old into this report, 2020 reported that the oxygen levels on the planet are growing. CO2 is being reduced because of the grasslands that are now being grown around the planet because of deforestation. Well, that's a natural process for the environment, is the collapse of forests. And they turn into grasslands, animals, birds, insects all return. They poop everywhere. You know, the grass burns, cracks open the pine cones. Now trees start to grow again. I mean, it's like a creek turning into a river, right? It goes through a cycle.
Yeah, goes through a cycle. Yeah. I don't know. We don't seem to understand that. I think I guess if you can't make a living any other way, you can be a politician. You know, if you can't stock shelves at Walmart intelligently,
that's right.
Run for office is my advice. I guess that's how it's gonna work. So, well, final thoughts, Shane, as we finish up here.
Well, we're blessed with our generation. All this has come about in the last 75 years, yours and my generation. Mm-hmm. You know, our parents, the great generation, came home, got educated, created the atomic family in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. We came along. we got educated because our parents did. And then all of a sudden, boom, all these engineers, biologists, archaeologists, geologists, you know, they went out and covered the planet and spent their entire lives, you know, like 60, 70 years studying what they learned. And more science has evolved in our lifetime than at other any other time in history. And look what it's created. That's why you and I always ask that incredible question. Why is North America, Canada, the United States, a first world in 100 years, and the world's been around, we can figure around 4,000 or 5,000 at least, right? And no one's gotten it right. So
yeah,
my final thoughts are thank you. Thank you to my and your generation for getting it done, for figuring it all out, for building, engineering, you know, mining, everything we talk about. Thank you, because you've made our lives better. We appreciate it. And I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you online, you know, 500 miles away to the world. Through social media and our little laptops, if it wasn't for our generation.
Amen to that. Absolutely right. Well, hey, I need to remind you, the award-winning Tom and Shane. We're live on the radio every Saturday, 8 to 11 Mountain Time. You can listen live at KMMSAM.com. Just click listen now and listen. Nothing to join, no signups, no nothing. You don't have to do anything. I mean, it's
just enjoy yourself.
It's as uncomplicated as we can possibly make it to do. So, and if you want a hint as to what we do, you can listen to our past shows, including this one will be up shortly. Tom and Shane past shows are also at KMMSAM.com. Just click on Tom and Shane podcast and pick the one you like. And our videos are there. Our radio shows are there. So that is all there for the for your enjoyment and your edification, so as they would say. So, all right. Thursday, we'll be back on Thursday morning with another amazing topic. So you
Give them a tease. What do you want to talk about?
Well, what are we talking about? Airlines?
All right.
They're we'll talk about airlines. Yeah, we'll talk about airlines on Thursday. So we'll see what's gonna what's up with that, because we can't find pilots. We don't have solar airplanes yet, or electric airplanes yet. But who knows? Somewhere down the road, we may have those things. So. All right, that's going to wrap it up for us today. Thanks for watching. Thanks for being here. And we will see everybody on Thursday.